Hello and welcome to The Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes towards writing. I'm your host, Sierra Walton. Today we bring to you recorded interviews from four different writers working in the professional fields of journalism, editing, publishing, and filmmaking. Each writer visited SSU during the 2014-2015 academic year to give talks and workshops for students on campus. All of them in their interviews explain how writing has helped them achieve success in their respective careers. Local writer Annabelle Carr discusses her work as the editor of Savannah Magazine, while Martin Staunton shares his experience and advice coming from his years as a reporter. Toward the end of the show, novelist Tina McElroy Ansa will reveal a bit of the business side of being a creative writer when she talks about what she's learned during her experience with the publishing industry. But first, we'll play for you an interview with SSU alumnus Miller Bergeron Jr., who talks about his work in film, including writing and directing the award-winning documentary Stubborn as a Mule, which explores the history of the call for reparations for African Americans. In addition to being a filmmaker, Bergeron is also an author and motivational speaker, empowering people to make positive changes in their lives with a process he calls Journey of a Successful Dreamer. Bergeron visited SSU in February 2015 for a Lunch and Learn talk sponsored by the QEP. Here, now, is part of the interview he gave following his presentation.
First and foremost, I just want to thank you for taking the time out of your life to come and share with Savannah State University student body about the documentary production and how to incorporate how writing is basically, you know, the foundation for creating a documentary or a film in any way of sort. Just to start, the first question is, we understand that you are a filmmaker, a business consultant, a motivational speaker, and an author. So how does writing play a key role in all of your professional endeavors, and to what extent has writing contributed to your success?
Writing has been probably the backbone of most of the things that I've done. Because before I go into a business meeting, before I go and do any consulting, before I start with the film process or writing a book, of course, there's writing involved. Everybody's so used to seeing the final product, used to seeing the screenplay or the documentary or reading the book once it's finished. Right. But there are many drafts that comes before that, whether it's the actual research and development, whether it's the proposals, whether it's the treatments, whether it's the many writing elements that go into the actual final product. So it dominates what I do, because even when I come to speak, I'm writing things out. I'm trying to make sure it's lined out. As you saw, I prepared a handout, and I like doing that because a lot of people, they listen, but they don't really listen. It's always good to have a handout, because if it was me, I would like to have a handout.
Right.
So I try to do things the way I would like it, as long as it's something feasible.
Right.
So writing dominates my life.
Okay.
In a good way.
I was thankful for the handouts too, because I was like, I know I'm around taking pictures, but I really want to listen to this. You directed and produced the internationally acclaimed film Stubborn as a Mule. The film has won several awards in the United States, Africa, Germany, and the United Kingdom.
Yes.
Can you explain the development and the preparation that went into the creation of this documentary?
It actually started, believe it or not, by praying. And I say that because we prayed for an idea. Mm. My partner and I, at the time, we said, you know, what is a good idea? We wanted to do something that was socially challenging, something that was just not the next best Girls Gone Wild video. It wasn't about the money. It was about really helping to shape people's perceptions, to give them some truth that they really have not really heard before or dealt with before. And so we actually came across the storyline of Stubborn as a Mule really with W.W. Law. You may be familiar with him, or you may have heard of him. He's a local historian. He's deceased now. A strong civil rights activist, not just for the Savannah area, but really for the nation. And he had commissioned a painting that depicted the 40 acres and a mule, what's really known as Special Field Order Number 15. That's the actual field order that the word 40 acres and a mule, or the phrase 40 acres and a mule came from. And from that, looking at the painting, it made us look at it deeper. So what is about this? And it talked about Savannah and how this was really the first attempt to get reparations, or the attempt to give reparations to African Americans for the atrocities suffered during slavery. And it all started here. General Sherman created Special Field Order No. 15, or 40 acres and a mule, as is proverbially referred to. He did it here. He met with 12 ministers, and that was the meeting that was depicted in this painting. It was General Sherman meeting with these ministers. And out of that meeting, he asked, what do you want? What do you need to go forward, basically? And they said, we need land. We need to be able to support our families. We need to be able to build crops, or to build our own infrastructure, basically, to basically level the playing field. Because you dealt with the people that were enslaved for 300-400 years. Now all of a sudden you're thrown out into mainstream society and they're telling you to live, but we don't have the tools that are needed. So reparations was that was that first attempt. Let's give them some land. They're used to tilling the land. They're used to surviving off the land because they're the ones that were handling the fields, doing all of that, dealing with the animals. We'll let them start there. And reading that, it was that thing that drew my attention. And it was like I said, when it comes to the documentary process or really any research process, the question is, what do I know about the subject matter? What is interesting to me about it? Is it something that is interesting to other people? And it answered all those questions as a yes. And I said, this is something that's gonna challenge some people, because reparations is a subject matter that most people wanna shy away from because they think it's about a handout. And it's not about a handout. Reparations, the word itself, means to repair the damage. And that was General Sherman's effort to repair the damage by giving the land. Now, the mule came in because they had army surplus mules that they did not want to take back up to the north. So they said, you know, let's give them the mules. They can use them to till the ground and use them for crop building. So that's where that actually come from. Because if you read the actual document, the Special Field Order No. 15, it says nothing about a mule. But reading other people who lived during that time and wrote about it, that's where it came from. But it was to repair the damage. And so many people, because they pull themselves away when they hear about possible money coming out of my taxpaying dollars, they're not thinking of it from the standpoint of it's coming directly out of my pocket, but they know if reparations would be given, it probably possibly would come from the government, which is my tax dollars at work.
Right.
So a lot of people, especially Caucasians, they tend to back away. And that's been the mode of society. I don't want to hear about it because they're asking for a handout. But in all actuality, we're not asking for a handout. Reparations was to say, let's repair the damage. And if you look at repairing the damage, damage control is not free. If you look at some of the studies that have been done now, there have been genetic studies that show that trauma, blunt trauma, any type of trauma is passed down genetically at some level, at many levels. And so if you had a fear of spiders, or if your mother had a fear of spiders, you may have a fear of spiders and you don't know why. A spider has never bitten you, you've never encountered one, but every time you see one, you're afraid of it.
Right.
And you'll find those little things in our lives, but it's because it's been transmitted genetically. And there have been scientific tests to start proving this now. So that post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic slave disorder, as one professor who's in the documentary has labeled it, Dr. Naeem Akbar, he says that it's been transmitted genetically to make us think and behave a certain way. And so the whole premise behind the documentary is let's cancel that perception that people have that it's about the money, and let them understand that in order to fix the ills of society, we have to deal with the problem. And the problem is going to require some money, because you're going to need to put people in therapy. You're going to need to educate people. You're going to need to build things around people to help them come up to the regular standard of society. And most people back away because they thought of it as from a money standpoint for so long. But when you look at Stubborn as a Mule, and it's not a controversial film, because what we did, we took the traditional U.S. history that everybody knows, and we added the black part of the U.S. history that the books don't tell you, or at least the history books don't tell you, the mainstream history books. And when you see everything line up, it fills in all the gaps. And it changes your mindset, because you have both sides to say, okay, now I can form a proper opinion. As opposed to what my mother or father or whoever was influencing me told me.
Right. On to our next question. How would you describe the difference between writing a script for a documentary versus writing a script for an original movie?
Two totally different trains of thought. Well, it depends. It can be somewhat the same, is somewhat different. Mm-hmm. Somewhat the same is in the sense that there are some documentary films that have reenactments. And it's not just canned footage that you get, but it's actually you get the actors, you get all the props, you put it in place, and you give the actors dialogue. So that part of your script may be scripted just like a regular narrative. Mm. But then again, you have the other parts where on the script, I may say, well, I want to put this interview from so-and-so here, and I'll get all kind of footage to back up with whatever you're saying.
Right.
And it's basically, that's the extent of it, because you don't know what they're going to say, and you don't know, based on what they say, you don't know what kind of footage you have to get to back it up. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the B-roll will need to be. So it's different from the sense that when you do a documentary script, it actually kind of lays more of a foundation, a framework, as far as that initial script. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to the latter part, then you're able to, it's never going to look like a regular narrative script, because the narrative script, as far as the interview section and the B-roll and stuff like that, it flows differently. There's no dialogue in it, right, per se. You may have some dialogue written in it because you're going to show your time codes, but it's usually just sections of sound bites, as opposed to dialogue between multiple people flowing a certain way, unless it was a particular interview that you did with multiple individuals.
Okay.
And you had people dialoguing that way. But it's a different approach. Similar but different. The very essence of it, though, and I always stress this, I didn't really talk about it today, but I always stress story. Because even though I'm doing a documentary, I'm still telling a story. And that's where a lot of, I won't say a lot, but there are some documentaries, especially early on, they kind of venture away from giving you a good story. And they say, I just give them facts. Oh, I want to do this, and I just want the facts to be there. But people don't want to watch facts. They read books for facts. If they're watching a film, whether it's documentary or narrative, they want to see an actual storyline. Mm-hmm. So what I like to do, I like to build in the storyline. I create a premise, basically, that goes back to that structure. Within that structure, I tell the story. And that's the key element that really ties all of it together. The actual writing of the script is different, because with a narrative, you can actually make it say whatever you want it to say. Mm-hmm. But you're never going to know what that interviewee is going
to
say.
Being that you are a Savannah State alumnus, can you describe to the current student body how important it is to embrace the writing culture?
It is important to embrace the writing culture, because you're going to find it no matter where you go. Mm. Whether you go into the federal government, whether you go into regular corporate America, whether you go into the film industry, whether you become a fireman, whether you become whatever, you're going to find it at every level. Mm-hmm. There's going to be at some point in time where you're going to have to write something. Yeah, even if it's as simple as you being a stay-at-home mother and you have to write a note for your daughter who couldn't come to school because she was sick with whatever, you have to be able to write no matter what you do, because you don't want to give off the perception that forces people away from you. Mm-hmm. Because depending on how you present your message, if it's coming across that you are an intelligent person, people will stop and listen. But the first couple of ignorant words they see written, they're like, okay, you know, I don't know about this. And so, yeah, writing is so important. People have to understand that, even the basics. And I guess the older I get, the more I see the things that I learned in school actually help me more than I ever thought. Because really, putting this presentation together today, I didn't, even though I guess I kind of do it inherently, but I didn't really think about the actual writing skills that are involved.
Right.
There are a lot of writing skills involved, and it can make or break whether you get money or not, depending on the tone that you gave to somebody. And that's why you have to do your research. What are they looking for? What is their understanding? And you have to present it to the audience where they can grab a hold of it and say, okay, I understand what he's saying. I like what he's saying. And on top of that, I like him. Mm-hmm. So let's do this. And you have to find that medium. But the first thing is your communication. And in writing, even if you're not going to present something in writing, your writing helps you, because it prepares you. It helps you say, okay, this is the structure of how I'm going to flow. This is what I'm going to say. And then based on that, then you go from there. So it's critical in everything that you do.
Okay, the last question is, writing for some people is just as tedious as math. For those who show a lack of interest in writing, what ways would you suggest that they approach writing in order to make it better for themselves?
Start writing about something that they're interested in. Mm-hmm. That helps so much. If you can find a subject matter that's of interest to you, or that's maybe not that is so interesting to you, but that is beneficial for you, then you see the need to do it. it helps that process much easier because you do something that you love quicker, mm-hmm. or you do something around something that you love quicker than you'll do it if you have no interest whatsoever. So just being able to find that subject matter, it's like when somebody is taking a creative writing class and they let you write on whatever you want. It's much more easier to do that as opposed to say, well, these are your topics, write something on it. Now granted, sometimes you have to do that,
yeah.
but to kind of get you in the mode, to get you in the process, it's good to just pick something that you're very interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically the research, because once you find out more information, the more information you have, the easier it is to be able to come back and put together an actual document that makes sense.
Exactly. Well, thank you once again for taking the time to sit down with us and discuss everything and share your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
I greatly appreciate
it. You're welcome.
It was a pleasure.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yont, the director of the Write Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
Hello, this is Kiara King from the Savannah State Writing Center. College professors expect that students will be able to ask for help when they need it. If you are unaware about what an assignment is asking you to do, take the time to meet with your instructor. All professors have office hours, which are usually listed in the syllabus. Be proactive and make a plan to get the help that you need.
The Write Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Write Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back to The Writer's Way. Next on our show is an interview with editor of Savannah Magazine, Annabelle Carr. Also a teacher, freelance writer, and a writer of short fiction, Carr gave a talk titled The Pen is a Sword, The Martial Art of Editing, when she visited SSU for a lunch and learn in March 2015. In her interview, she discusses how writing has impacted her life, shares writing advice, and reveals the skills one needs to be a successful editor.
Hello, everyone. Today, we have Miss Annabelle Carr, who is the editor of Savannah Magazine, Savannah Homes, and Savannah Weddings, producing 10 magazine issues a year along with a number of auxiliary titles. She holds a BA in Narrative Arts from Davidson College and an MFA in Writing from Lesley University, and she also teaches and writes freelance on her spare time. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Miss Annabelle Carr. How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm great, thanks.
Thank you for sitting down with us. Okay, so like I said before, you've been an editor for years. So mm-hmm. what are some of the things that you enjoy most about being an editor?
Mm. Well, I love sitting down and getting ideas together for a new issue.
Mm-hmm.
We start out with just a few ideas about what each issue's theme is going to be. And then we get to find out what's going on right now that ties into the theme and, you know, we get to think visually about the magazine as well as just word-wise. Like, magazine mm-hmm. editing is a lot of collaboration with art, so that's really fun. And so that high-level planning period is really, really fun. And then mm-hmm. when you get into executing it and when reality starts to, you know, try to measure up to your expectations and it can't, that can be a little bit of a downer. And so then this other fun part comes in where you're then fighting to make it as good as it can be and to get it as close to your vision as possible. And I mean, you win some, you lose some, but it's a fun battle, and it's definitely, you know.
You make it seem so fun, especially the way that you smile when you talk about it. I imagine that it takes a tremendous amount of patience and mm-hmm. also a keen eye and imagination for a person to be an editor. So what are some skills or qualifications that a person must have to be a successful editor?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to be a passionate reader more than anything. And I can always tell if a writer is really a writer by how their ear is with, if they can hear when something sounds wrong, if they can hear the rhythm and kind of can instinctively self-correct, if they can, you know, evoke something, almost invoke
right.
something, catalyze a response in people, you know. It always comes down to, are they a reader themselves? When they read, do they get goosebumps? You know, if that doesn't happen, then they might be able to deliver good facts in a timely manner, but they're not going to give me everything I need as a writer. Now, for an editor, I think you need those same skills, but then you also have to have maybe that even higher vision of what's going on. It's not just about filling a certain niche within the magazine or, you know, within the publishing world, but it's about really seeing the big picture and what else you can add to it.
Right.
You know, so always thinking, yes, and I can also do this, and how about this, you know? Something about seeing that bigger picture and still having that ear for the one sort of off bit of rhythm, that one thing that needs a comma, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to shift focus. I guess that's, if I could break it down, if I could edit what I just said and say one thing, it would be, is that ability to shift focus from high level to minutiae very quickly and precisely. That's fun.
Okay, hearing about your writing made me curious to ask, what or how do you characterize your literary influences, if you have them?
Oh my goodness. Number one is James Baldwin.
Okay.
James Baldwin was my formative writer. He taught me that you don't have to fit a certain mold to write from that perspective. Like, he was a gay black man, he could write a married white woman, he could write any age, any interests, he could know the human heart so well. And that just captivated me, and that love of character and that fascination with, you know, creating the world that would shape the actions of a person. I'll never forget another country when I realized who the book was really about. And that really made me love fiction. It made me love the possibilities, you know, because here, and I don't want to do a huge spoiler on the book, but the book appears to be about a cast of incredibly diverse characters.
Right.
And then at some point it just sort of struck me that the character this book's really about is barely in it at all, you know?
Mm.
And that, like, made me so excited, like, oh, there's so many different ways to tell one story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that gets me excited. One of the problems with that, of course, is there are so many ways to tell one story, you really gotta narrow it down to just one at some point, you know?
That's so hard.
Stop starting your novel, you know what I mean? So, yeah, James Baldwin is number one. There are so many. The editors that we talked about today in my presentation, each one of them has inspired me. Diana Vreeland, Max Perkins, Bob Gottlieb. But yeah, in terms of just discovering the complete magic of writing and like how abundant it is and how many possibilities there are, it was James Baldwin all the way.
I love James Baldwin too.
Me too. And I love that he didn't let himself get pigeonholed, you know?
Right.
He was really controversial because he was just like, hey, I'm a person,
it
you know?
Was.
I'm not going to serve any one political agenda. I'm just going to, like, be true. And I think because of that, he reached people who wouldn't have understood where he was coming from until they read his stuff, you know? Who wouldn't have understood him from the outside but could understand him from the inside out.
Right. Reading his pieces made me... I guess find more of myself in my writing. Like,
mm-hmm.
I was able to identify myself at that point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so being that writing is a key factor in your career, how has writing inspired you or impacted your life?
Well, I mean, the number one thing is it's like funded my tiny household, so that's been really great. You know, it's actually been coming to Savannah State and teaching adjuncts here, the composition class, where I've really realized what writing can do for everyone, not just the writer. Like, for anyone who has to write something, you have this opportunity to think in a way that you couldn't without writing. Like, without writing, it's harder to focus. You know, I have one great idea, and then the next minute I'm watching this, and then the blah, blah, blah. Never come back to that idea. Maybe years later I'm like, oh yeah, I thought about that once, you know? But writing allows you, and it also forces you to think deeper. You can go further, the distance of your thought, because you're not constantly interrupting yourself, you know? So it's an opportunity to explore while you still have like a lead line, you know, connecting you to your thoughts. You know, you can follow it in a linear way. There's I think it was Kurt Vonnegut who wrote Harrison Bergeron. I'm pretty sure it was Vonnegut. And it's a short story that's like an allegory for, you know, modern times, I guess. And in it, it's science fiction, but everybody wears these handicapping devices to like make so that no one can stand out or have any advantages. Everybody's trying to be the same. So this character, Harrison Bergeron, right? He's really smart, he's really handsome, he's really athletic, whatever. So he's got like these weights on his limbs to keep him from being too graceful. And he's got like this bell. It's actually his dad who's really smart. So his dad has a bell that goes off like every 2 minutes really loudly, and he forgets his train of thought, you know? And I think that that's more and more what life is like these days. Like, I literally have a bell that goes off pretty much every 2 minutes telling me, you know, I've got a text or I've got a, you know, call or whatever, and I get distracted. And to have this opportunity to just have this long, you know, connected thought process, that's what writing gives us. That, you know, if we don't have that, we'll lose so much of the individual, you know. And sometimes I look at my class here and I think, you know, there's so many people here like, that guy just said this great idea and I would never have known it if I hadn't forced him to talk, you know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, and I just think, you know, let's give people a way to pull themselves out of the canyon of their own inner thinking, mm-hmm. and follow their thought to its conclusion and see where they get. And then they can share that with other people. If that one individual doesn't have that opportunity, you know, some idea could be lost. You know, some unique idea could be lost. So putting writing in the hands of these individuals with their own unique stories can be really exciting.
Wow, I never thought of it like that. I really didn't.
I want it to be that exciting for them, but they're more like, I have to, and I want to be like, no, you can.
it's hard, especially for a lot of students to be motivated when writing, because it's something you have to do when you're here, something that you're forced to do, and nobody really wants to be forced to do anything. So that's why, I don't know, in a sense, I kind of depend on my professors to make me want to do this paper about hidden intellectualism, which I really don't understand, but I'm just like, hidden intellectualism. And then if they explain it in a way that pertains to you or your life, or something, the smallest thing from that pertains to something that you've experienced, or something that you can relate to, and then, you know, from that one idea you can write an eight page paper, it's just so amazing to me. And I really depend on my professors for that, because it really takes the right person to bring that out of you.
Yeah.
And I consider myself a writer as well, and oftentimes I experience writer's block.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just me, but others who are serious writers sometimes face problems when writing.
Right.
So my question to you is, are there any obstacles that you face in the writing process, and if so, how do you overcome them?
Well, I have a whole bunch of cheats and formulas for my day job, right? Because I know how many pages I need to fill, and I gotta fill them no matter what. I know what my deadline is, so I can't afford to have writer's block in my day job. So I know sort of, I have my own little sort of toolbox of ways in, you know. If I'm gonna address my writer and I've got my reader and I've got a page that I need to fill, I think I've got this topic, okay? I could ask a question about their experience, and say 50% of them say yes. You know, do you ever have this problem? That's not exactly what I'll do, but that idea, you know. So I just grab them with a question and now they can kind of relate, blah 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 blah, right? Or I jump in with something that's like an observation that we can all share, like, man, it's hot in Savannah. Okay, that's also an oversimplification. But, you know, immediately it's like, oh, yeah, it's freaking hot. What are we going to do? And then now I can turn it into a style thing, because it's too hot to wear anything that's on the runways right now. So here's what we are going to wear. You know, this one little trend that, you know, actually made it into stores and, you know, is conservative enough that you can wear it on, you know, whatever. So there's like a whole, how do you identify with your reader and pull them in a little bit, having that hook. And sometimes it's the same three hooks that I keep coming back to, like, don't we have this in common? Do you have a problem? Well, I've got a solution, you know? What's gonna make these people, you know? And then after that, you're just sort of bantering with your hook a little bit, you know? That gets me going on the day job front. The creative writing that I do/want to do, it's a whole other story. And so that's why I was encouraging people in my talk to sort of hire themselves as a writer. If I sit down and give myself an assignment to do, I'm gonna do it, you know, or at least if I take it seriously enough, I'm gonna do it.
Right.
And I can fill that prescription that I wrote, and I'll have a piece that I can then edit into whatever I want. But more often than not, and I think this is just the writer's dilemma, I find myself sort of stumbling around in front of the door trying to find another way in, you know, like bumping up against the walls, beginning the same story over and over again, you know, everybody wants to get to that place in writing where they're on a roll and they know what they're doing and they're excited and the next thing's coming. But we all have that moment when we're just trying to get in the door, you know? And I think it's just about if I was a little more disciplined, if I was a little less cashed out on my day job, you know, I think I could make it into that door more often than I do, you know? So I'm like everyone else. I'm like every other writer in the world in that, you know, there's something more that I want to do that I'm always, you know, trying to push myself to accomplish.
That made me think about a story that I started on my own that I wasn't able to finish. I started maybe in high school, and I really thought to myself, I was like, wow, I'm writing this like way ahead of my time. I was like, I really don't know. I want a character that is, I'm trying to create a character that's way older than me, and I have yet to have experienced these things that I want my character to have experienced. So I had to put it on hold because I wouldn't be able to understand what I was trying to put my character through and things of that nature. Now, maybe 4 or 5 years later, I've revisited that story, and I should have saved it, but in my mind when I was a little younger, I was like, well, if I didn't finish it now, I'm just gonna delete it. It doesn't matter now, but you were supposed to always keep your word no matter what. Yeah. Now I know that, but I've been given the opportunity to create a short video or film. So maybe I'm thinking maybe I should take that piece that I wasn't able to finish and try to make it come to life. And then maybe some inspiration can spring up from there.
Right.
So that's just my idea.
Well, if it makes you feel any better about throwing that out, I've had pieces I've hung on to and then tried to use years later. Mm-hmm. And they're never as good as I remember they were. And it's more like the work I did back then is useful, but the actual work I have to show for it is just like it's like trying to put life back into a corpse. It's just kind of gross and and not useful, but it's better to just know that you'd paid some dues when you wrote it the first time. And when you sit down to write it now, that will come through in the new version, you know? I can think of some things I tried to breathe life into.
It's like when you go back, you're just like, what was I thinking? Well, thank you so much, Ms. Carr, for sitting down and talking with me today.
Yeah,
on behalf of the QEP and Savannah State University, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was fun talking with you.
Welcome back. This is The Writer's Way, and today we've been listening to interviews with writers working in various fields of mass communications and journalism. Our next author is Martin Staunton, a veteran reporter with more than 25 years of experience who currently works for WSAV in Savannah. Staunton has covered a wide range of stories throughout his career, including traveling to and reporting on the war in Afghanistan. In spring 2015, he came to SSU to give a talk titled, How Writing Changed and Saved My Life. What we will play for you now is part of an interview Staunton gave following his talk. Hello, everyone. Today, I'd like to introduce Martin Fitzgerald Staunton. He relishes the role of general assignment reporter and has even spent some time embedded with troops in Afghanistan. Martin has covered crime, consumer issues, government, the military, and also politics. He also has extensive investigative experience in reporting. Martin brings nearly 30 years of broadcast experience to the WSAV News team. So now I want to extend a warm welcome to Mr. Martin Fitzgerald Staunton.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I feel very welcome. I do. How are you?
I'm great, actually.
Good.
I enjoyed listening to you speak at the Lunch and Learn today.
Thank you.
Now, to get into it, the first question I want to ask you is, can you explain to us the difference between writing for radio versus writing for television news, especially to our mass communications department here at Savannah State University?
Yes, and there is a big difference, and they should note the difference. Always remember when you're talking about broadcast television or broadcasting an image that your words support the pictures. In radio, your words are the pictures. You can use sound, like natural sound, if I'm doing a story about, I don't know, say they're going to renovate Daffin Park. Mm-hmm. I might use, in radio stories, I would use sounds of maybe the birds and maybe sounds of the construction work that's going on. You know, that beep, 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 where the truck goes backwards. All of those paint a mental image for you when you're listening to the radio. But in television, you're soaking in the image first. So your words need to support those pictures. Like, for example, say I'm doing the same story, Daffin Park renovation. I would open up with that same natural sound, but you would see that truck backing up. Boom, boom, boom. They're reversing the role of the park here. The park is in for a renovation. That way, what I tried to do, and it's advice that I got from what I called at the time an old timer. Now I'm the old timer, regurgitating his advice. It's good. In broadcast television, write to the four corners of the picture. Look at that composition of the frame, right to the corners of the picture, and then that way you will cover the whole image and it makes a more powerful impact for the viewer.
What writing skills must a person have if they want to be qualified to obtain a career in journalism?
You have to have a solid, strong command of the English language. You have to know if you have a dangling participle. You have to know if you're using a double negative. You have to know when to use an apostrophe. You definitely need to know the rules of capitalization, because the rules of grammar don't just apply to what we're saying in the writing. It applies to what we see when we put a person's title under their name. General Colin Powell. Do you know the right abbreviation for general, where the period goes, what gets capitalized? That's text that goes on. So we're actually sharing. And the minute we get that wrong, we lose credibility. And credibility is everything in news. And so part of being credible is knowing the English language. You have to not only know it, you have to recognize it, because you're going to run into other people who don't know it. They'll be like, you know, I'll write something like, I'd be doing good. It's like, what? This is not Oakland news. This is like English language news. I actually had this happen to me. I was in the store, and that's a terrible habit, I know, but I smoke. Mm-hmm. And so I order my cigarettes at the convenience store. And I asked the young lady, I say, may I have a package of cigarettes? And immediately the dude in front of me goes, dang, that's the whitest sounding black man I've ever heard. And I didn't know that there was a certain sound to being black, but if using proper English or just, and I only said package because I didn't want to say pack. You know, I like to break it up like that. I use my vocabulary. What's good of using, having words and not using them?
Exactly.
And so I try to use them. But in that instance, not only did he make the scene at the counter when I got outside the store, whomever he was with, and he was a scrub because he was getting in the back seat of a car full of girls and he wasn't driving. He was riding in the back. And he's like, look at that dude. That's the whitest sounding brother I ever seen. It made me angry. Just in that, you know, A, I can't help how I sound. But B, there's nothing wrong with using proper English. And, you know, people actually, I know people who know the right things to say, but they say the wrong things so that they can be cool around the people that matter to them. And, I don't know. I'm just not down with breaking those rules of grammar just to impress somebody. That doesn't mean that you're hip. It just means that you're wasting your money and time on your education if you do it wrong.
Right. I understand that now. My mom is an educator. Mm. And when I'm at home, you know, you're within the...
She corrected you all the time, right?
Yes. And it drove me crazy. But then at this point right now, I realize why she's done it. Because once we speak and we text like that, it becomes embedded in our unconscious.
And you can't... It is so hard to shed a bad habit. Easy to pick up a bad habit. It's very hard to get rid of them, especially in writing. And some people use cliches like crutches. And some people butcher the rules of grammar and punctuation like it doesn't matter, and then they forget, and then they can never get it right. And I'm telling you, editors and executive producers will get tired of that, especially once it actually makes air. There should be two or three sets of eyes that sees a script before it ever makes air. But in those instances, when those type of mistakes get through, you only get a few chances of making that, and they will fire you.
Right. I find myself very, I don't necessarily want to say that I get frustrated, but it is frustrating, especially when you interview people, because I interview people, and especially when it's students, and their grammar is poor. It's so poor that I'm just like, maybe I won't use this take. Maybe I won't use this.
And isn't that such a shame, that a lack of the command of the English language would keep you from sharing your thoughts and ideas with the masses, if that's what you want to do, especially if you're a mass comm major. You're a mass comm major and you can't communicate on an individual level properly. That's a problem. Mm.
As a reporter, what are the most important steps of your writing process?
comprehension, first and foremost. When I say know your subject, I have to know what I'm reporting on. I can't report, and I see many reporters do this. Many journalists do this. They'll try to write a story about something they don't understand. How can you possibly explain something that you yourself don't grasp? The first step in the process is understanding what I'm writing about. Once I have that, then I, just like you learn in your writing syllabus, I'll write an outline. I'll do it in my head, or what I've been using anymore is I love that talk and texting. You know, I can talk and send myself an email. Mm-hmm. It's like I got a secretary. I'll be like, and so, like today, for example, five people detained following a clandestine lab found on the inside of the Midtown East 63rd Street, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. I can dictate my whole story and then push send, and I haven't had to type anything. Then I can go back and copy and paste and revise it. So I'm typing just a little bit. Not only does it help me get it out on paper and get that very important, whatever I write, I always write a rough draft. The rough draft never gets turned in. There's always a rewrite. Mm-hmm. Whether I'm writing a letter, mm-hmm. whether sometimes even when I'm writing a text to my fiance, oh, I love you, honey, you know, roses are red, violets are blue, ooh, 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 I love you. I don't like that ooh, ooh part. So when I go back, I will rewrite a text, girl. I'll rewrite a text. And so the rewrite is very important because that way we can condense and make it simple, going back to the point of easy to understand. To me, if I'm successful in writing, I've written it once, they've read it once, and they got 100% comprehension from what I wrote.
See, that's one thing that I've grasped is rewriting, which is one of the most important parts of the writing process. Mm-hmm. Because I wrote a poem, mm-hmm. and I was just anxious about getting it out, mm-hmm. and I just sent it to the person that requested the poem, and I ran it past my family at the last minute, uh-huh. and they were like, oh, it's good, but you know, you're writing it for this event and you don't want to make them feel like, because in a sense my grandfather was like, it's kind of like you're belittling the people that you're, you know, that asked you to do right. the event. So I was like, oh my gosh, I sent this poem.
Could you see his point when he pointed
I did
out?
Okay. I did, and you don't see that unless you go get other people to help you to revise and look
well,
at
you
your
know
paper
what? Here, let mm-hmm. me share something mm-hmm. to you with you that I didn't tell anybody in that workshop just now. Mm-hmm. And I should have, because it's important. Read it out loud. When you're right. done, don't just look at it and think, oh, this sounds good. Let your ear hear it. Soak it in so that you can, A, listen for bad grammar. Mm-hmm. You can also hear if something doesn't sound kind of like what your grandfather was saying. If you could be condescending, because the other point I didn't make is that, especially if you're writing something that you're going to be speaking to people, mm-hmm. which you do when you're in a broadcast journalist, you need to know your audience. Mm-hmm. And one of the last things you want to do is offend them. Because mm-hmm. guess what? They become an X audience. If you want them to read the next thing that you've done, if you've offended them, then they're not going to be nearly as inclined to do so. Mm. Unless you're giving away free money.
Can you describe the importance of presenting factual information when reporting? And what could happen if a person does relay false information?
Well, depending on the level of the falsehood of the information, you can be sued for, I always get them confused. Okay, for libel. Mm-hmm. Libel is written knowingly, with malice, writing something to damage someone's reputation right. is basically the essence of libel. And you've caused basically kind of what I explained, irreparable damage. You can, mm-hmm. a person can build their reputation over a lifetime and then a good reputation and then lose it overnight. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know whether they're true or not, but a perfect modern-day example of that is this time last year, if you'd have asked me to name one of the most respected and beloved television father figures in the world ever, who would we talk about?
Bill Cosby.
If we mentioned him today, even if all of those women, if all and all and all of those women are not being truthful, does he ever get his reputation mm-hmm. back? Another example that is really true, do you remember, you're probably young, but you may remember, they held the Olympics in Atlanta. Mm. You knew that, right?
I did.
Okay. In the Atlanta, yes, it was 96. And in those Olympics, there was a terrorist attack. Mm. The FBI leaked the name of a suspect that wasn't the guy.
Wow.
And to this day, there are people who believe that that man, Richard Jewell, is the Olympic Park bomber, and he was not. But they pointed the finger at him early. And what came out of that, that still lives on today in law enforcement, was it was the first time ever I heard, and many heard, that they didn't call him a suspect. He was, quote, a person of interest. Mm. No one had heard that phrase before Richard Jewell. But Richard Jewell rightfully won a lot of money for them misidentifying him. So the point being, it's important to be factually right so that you don't get sued. But also, at the end of the day, a real honorable journalist just wants to get the facts to his readers or his listeners or their viewers. And they want to get it right. They want to get it right the first time. And I'm one of those.
What advice can you give to students who are currently pursuing a degree in mass communications and journalism?
A, you have to ask yourself that if you're doing this for the money, that's the wrong reason. Most journalists don't get rich. Some of them do. Some of them make very, very, very big money. But for the most part, teachers make more. If you're in a small market, depends on the size of the city. But you can't do this job or any job mainly for the money. It's the wrong reason to do it. You're going to find very little satisfaction, because even when your bank account is fat, or even if it never gets fat, it's work. Satisfying work is about more than money. So don't expect to get rich, but expect to meet a lot of interesting people. Expect to make a real difference in your community. Expect that sometimes, every once in a while, you can be a real hero to someone who has no one else to turn to except for someone who can help them with their problem. And journalists absolutely can do that, because when you ask policymakers and people in power the right question, especially when they're stepping on the little guy, they get to fixing stuff very quickly. And nothing feels as good as standing up to a person who was elected to an office and holding their feet to the fire to make them live up to a promise. I once had a man who was a governor tell me that I had more power than he did, and I said, I don't understand, Governor Wise, why do you mean I have more power? How can I have more power than you? You're the governor. He says, it's simple, because you have the power to change a person's mind in an instant. I can talk for hours and never do that. But they can look at one report from you, and in a minute and 30 seconds, you can change their mind.
Wow. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. And
you're welcome.
Giving Savannah State University a nice lunch and learn today, learning more about you and your experiences as a reporter and a journalist. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Deanne Goins, a professional writing tutor at the SSU Writing Center, and I bring you the Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day. When two or more singular nouns or pronouns are connected by or nor, use a singular verb.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
We're glad to have you back with us. This is The Writer's Way. We'll wrap up our show today with an interview with Tina McElroy Ansa, who is a novelist, filmmaker, publisher, teacher, and journalist. Ansa, whose fiction is influenced by her years of listening to stories while growing up in Middle Georgia, is the founder and publisher of Down South Press, as well as the founder of the Sea Island Writers Retreat. In her interview, she explains how she navigated the often frustrating world of publishing, first as an author, and then as a publisher. She gives us a glimpse at the often overlooked business side of creative writing, and her advice is sure to be helpful for any aspiring writer. The interview was conducted by SSU alumna, D'Orlena Natera, at SSU.
And these are your troubles with publishers and all the things of the writing world. Is that something that you teach your writers in your program in the Sea Island Writers?
The one thing that I tell people about publishing is they are asps and adders, okay? You are in a snake's den when you walk in, and no one told me that. The people who were my mentors were older people, and they really had been part of publishing when publishing was a quote unquote what they called gentlemen's, you know, gentlemen's profession. And I grew up thinking about, you know, the editors, the famous editors who would come to your home and sit across the kitchen table and lend you $100 if you needed it. You know, I've been reading these stories about, you know, Rawlins and all these folks, and I really wanted that, and I thought that's what it was. And when I got in there, oh no, you know, we acquire your story, we don't even know who you are. No, you know, the big thing is in a publishing company, this is so awful, but I tell all of my horror stories because I don't want y'all to have horror stories. I don't want you going in blind. Mm-hmm. You know, no, these people don't care about you. They don't care about you. They're working on your work, your editor, you would love for her to be your friend and all the rest. She may not even be there next week. You know, there's a lot of moving around, and you know, your book may be orphaned. That's what they call it, when somebody who has acquired your book leaves. And they say, oh, your book has been orphaned, you know, and so they tell you, oh, don't worry, somebody will pick it up. Nobody will pick it up. I mean, what you have to understand is that, you know, that this is a business. Publishing is a business, and the larger publishers could be publishing, could be making brooms or shoes. They're looking at products. Mm-hmm. So to me, that behooves writers and editors to care even more about their work. Because as I said earlier, you know, now you do not turn anything in unless you have your own editor look at it, if you're smart. Because there's no editing, line editing going on in publishing anymore. It's just about getting it out. So you have to be very much in charge of your own destiny, period. Whether you're, you know, signing with a big publishing house, a small publishing house, or starting your own publishing house, it's really all a matter of being in charge of your own stuff and not being afraid. Ah, can I tell you? Mm-hmm. I spent most of my from maybe 13 to, when did I meet your name? 26, 27, 28, being a sissy. Sissy, oh my goodness, you know, oh no, you know, I mean, classic sissy, oh no, I have on heels, we'll have to take a cab, oh no, you can't put the top down, my hair blows, you know, that kind of sissy. But also, because I was baby of the family, I was a sissy, everybody had fought my battles for me, you know. But I've never been in a fight, I've never had to, you know, I should be, mm-hmm. had to, you know, like defend a schoolyard fight or any of those things, you know. A lot of things were made easy for me, so I had to do a lot of growing up as an adult. And so that made it kind of difficult, because I was a sissy in the sense of taking chances. I was afraid. Mm-hmm. I was a little shy. Journalism made me bold. Oh, bold as hell. It was just unbelievable the things that I would do. And my first assignment, I was on the copy desk at first, which I loved. And I would be telling people, you know, oh, rewrite that. That's awful. That's a terrible thing. And then they said, you want to go on, you know, you want to go on the news side and, you know, do. And I was a reporter. Oh, my goodness, you know. I realized that all this stuff that I've been telling people as an editor, I needed to learn. That was heartbreaking for me to tell them to rewrite that lead, you know, when you thought that. So I sort of learned that. So journalism made me bold. And then taking the step to leave journalism, you know, to write, mm-hmm. which is what we did. I knew, you know, I didn't have a job. My husband had a job, and that was going to, you know, keep us going. But I didn't want the responsibility of everything being on him. The point of me writing was to be able to contribute to the family. Other things are things that you use. Mm-hmm. But I was a sissy most of my life, and journalism made me stronger, and being published made me stronger, because it didn't take me long to see these people don't care about my work. And, you know, I'm going to have to be there. You know, they came up with this ugly cover for my book. And it was a little girl, and she was faceless. And she had on a little baptismal outfit. And it was just like a stick, you know, kind of figure. And it's an all-black background. It was menacing and scary and culturally incorrect. And, I mean, it was just awful. And the only thing that saved me is that everybody from the edit, from the publisher down, hated it. When they, I mean, they just looked at it, hey, but we were close. And again, they paid me $12,500 for my whole advance. Mm-hmm. $12,500 for my first book. And so, you know, I didn't have a budget, and, you know, they were just gonna, and I said, well, this is it. So I said, well, I know an artist, and the Scholastic and the art department for Harcourt Brace at that time was in San Diego. And the art director, I said, who? She said, I said, no, I didn't say I know an artist. I said, well, what about Barnett Honeywood? who went to school with me. People say, you're behind me at Spelman. You know, she, her stuff was on the Cosby Show, mm-hmm. the original Cosby Show walls. And that's how she became, you know, famous. She did the little bill books with my Mr. Cosby,
yeah.
as she calls him, Mr. Cosby, and called him. And the guy laughed at me on the phone. He said, we can afford Barnett Honeywood. And I said, well, we went to college together. He said, get her on the phone right now. Call her right now. We'll send her a manuscript. And we sent the manuscript to her. And I found out later she was in the middle of doing a one-woman show. And she stopped it and called me back and said, I got the manuscript. I love it. Let's do it. What do you want?
Wow.
She let me choose it was a collage instead mm-hmm. of a painting. What's that word called? She let me choose the medium. There we go. Mm-hmm. She let me choose the medium. I loved her collages. And so then she called me back. She was in LA, and I was in on St. Simon's on this coast. And she would call me and say, "Well, I'm thinking of doing a family portrait. What do you think?" And I said, "A family portrait would be wonderful." And then she'd call me back and she says, "Okay, Jonah, the father. He's like dark skin. Is he like dark skin? Chocolate, coffee, black coffee?" She gave me the whole, and I chose. And then she called back and said, "Okay, I know Nellie is kind of high. You know, kind of." She is light skinned, kind of how yellow. She has this red hair. And the red hair was important in the book. And Barnett and I had both been in Atlanta in school. And my sister and I, there's this color of red that black women of a certain color, of a certain age, start dyeing their hair. Do you know that red? Everybody knows what the red I'm talking about? It's not that brassy red, but it's that red. And they all have that red of a certain color. That was sort of, and my sister and I call it Auburn Avenue Red, because, you know, of Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. And I said to Barnett, she called, she says, "No, her hair is red. Is it like blonde red? Is it strawberry blonde? Is it red?" And I said, "It's Auburn Avenue Red." She said, "Say no more, I don't." And so it turned into a wonderful experience, but I'm saying that I brought all of this to the, you know, to the table. And so when I started thinking about it, I said, you know, well, I've been doing everything except, you know, editing my own books. And I mean, I had an editor, but literally editing my own books and cranking them out and, you know, hand selling them. And I said, I can do that. I can do a better job than they were doing. So that's what empowered me. But I think it had something to do with age too, you know, mm-hmm. because I had published for a couple of decades and I'd been a journalist for, you know, so I felt empowered. Mm-hmm. And I hope people listen. People, men and women, young men listening to this will say, okay, you know what, I can just skip that, you know, Tina had to go through that. I'm going to skip over that and just be empowered, you know, and know that maybe let's not go through these steps. You know, let's go straight here. Let's not be shy about our work. Let's not be afraid to share our work. Let's not be afraid to, you know, be a part of a writer's group because, you know, we need to get on it. You know, someone was talking about, I don't even use the word writer's block. You know, we just, whenever that comes up, we just say, you know, number one, we don't use the word, so we don't identify it and glorify it. And that just means you need to do something else. All that means you need to go to a movie, you know, you need to go for a walk, you need to go something else, and come back to it. But that's experience. But you don't have to experience that. You can hear me say that and do it. You know, so I like the stepping stones, the idea of my writer's retreat, not only creating writers, but also being a stepping stone. We go, oh, I can jump over those three steps. Oh, I can jump over those three steps. And, you know, and I see my folks just, you know, moving forward.
What is one last tip that you would leave writers, fellow writers, that you would want them to take away from you?
Oh, so much stuff. Okay, let's see. Oh, okay. If you are a writer, claim your spot. If you are a writer, be a writer. You're not a writer if you're talking about your work, if you're planning on doing your work. You're a writer if you put your butt in the seat every single day. Every single day and write. That's what I would take. And I know they've been told that before, but I'm telling you, that's the way to be a writer. Good writers write. Good writers write. That would be it.
Write
every day and respect your writing.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure, sweetie.
That's all for this episode of The Writer's Way. Thank you for tuning in. We hope that you have not only been entertained, but also inspired by hearing from the fantastic writers, SSU alumnus Miller Bergeron Jr., Annabelle Carr, Michael Staunton, and Tina McElroy Ansa. Whether you are thinking about starting a career in journalism, publishing, or mass communications,
or you're simply on the lookout for some good writing advice, we hope today's show has given you something to think about for your own writing. I wish to thank those who helped make this show possible, including the authors themselves, SSU alumna D'Orlena Natera, the QEP's own Adriana de Oliveira, and Lisa Yant, as well as Ryan Clark for his help in production, and Ike Carter and Grace Curry at the WHCJ for their support. Have a pleasant day, and tune in next time for more The Writer's Way. I'm your host, Sierra Walton. Don't forget that you can listen to all of the Right Attitude radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu.